This week's podcast is sponsored by Whitney Antiques, an antique shop in the heart of Oxfordshire, specialising in historic needlework. If you'd like to know more about Whitney Antiques, check out their website at www.whitneyantiques.com. Welcome to Unearth of Past. I am Dr. Michaela Hume, and this week we will be delving into the past of a man that needs no introduction. When it comes to boxing history, this man certainly made his. 46 fights with 39 wins, 17 by the way of knockout, 6 losses and 1 draw. Martin Murray is the former British and Commonwealth middleweight champion and 5 times world title challenger. His professional debut came in September 2007 with victory at the Robin Park Arena in Wigan. He went on to fight a who's who of legendary fighters, including Sergio Martinez, Gennady Golovkin, Felix Sturm, Billy Joe Saunders, to name but a few. Headlining arenas and stadiums across the globe, from London to Monte Carlo to Buenos Aires, Martin blended a tough, uncompromising style, a fierce work ethic with silky boxing skills and knockout power in either hand. Truly a fighter's fighter. That same work ethic can now be seen in his new endeavours as a professional boxing coach at the Wildcard Gym in his hometown of St. Helens, passing on his knowledge to up-and-coming fighters under his watchful eye. He can also be found back in the community with his social education and boxing-based program, Think Fast, aiming to equip young people with the life skills needed to create better futures for themselves. Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks a lot. I think that's the best introduction I've ever had. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So how did you end up boxing? And I know that you've been very honest in interviews that I've watched in the past about your younger years, but how did you end up on this fantastic journey with that amazing career that I've just spoke about?
Obviously, boxing's always been, where I'm from, is St. Helens. It's a well-known boxing town. Obviously, rugby league's the first sport, but over the years, it's produced a lot of good fighters.
Yeah.
Couple of them turned pro, not really done anything. There was a couple who could have turned pro and really done something. One world titles, people like John Lyon, but he never stayed amateur. But usually what you find is when there's loads of talent there, but when they get to 17, 18, they just, society takes over, and that's what it did with me. Like, I was never a bad person, I say this, but I made some terrible, poor life choices. Obviously with that comes consequences of what you've done, and sadly I ended up in prison 4 times. So, you know, it kind of like setback after setback. I kind of picked myself up thinking, right, I'm getting on straight in there now, and someone was always coming back from the past, mm-hmm. sending me back down. And, you know, I got back into, going on to why I got into boxing, like I said, I've only ever known boxing. There's always been a pair of boxing gloves in our family. Like I said, it's the area, and then it was a big part of it goes down to it's down to a man called Johnny Chisnall, who sadly passed away in 2005.
Chizzy,
yeah, and he was Johnny was a former professional fighter. Come from famous. There was 4 famous brothers in St. Helens. 3 of them played rugby league. Eric, Les and Dave, and one of them did boxing, pro boxing.
Right.
Johnny Chiz. And Johnny was just dead passionate, also getting young people. He kind of, from hearing him talk and what he spoke to me about over the years, he wasted his career by drinking and going out and, you know, being overweight and fighting the wrong weight. And he was like passionate about making young people make the same mistakes as he did. So he used to turn up on our estate. The first memory I've got of obviously going to boxing him was being on our estate. Same She's constantly stating, saying, telling. My mum still lives in the same estate we grew up in. And Johnny Chiz just turned up on his bus, and he you wouldn't get away with it now, but he just had loads of kids and he was throwing it back at Van. So that my first memory of going to boxing, Johnny Chiz with him throwing me back of a van. Doesn't sound right, does it? You won't get away with it these days, I'm likely so, yeah. But he took me to the gym. He was a trusted pillar of the community. Took me to the gym and I went there and I loved it. And for me, that was my safe space. There was a lot going on at home at the time. With obviously my dad having a criminal past,
yeah.
In and out the care system, he didn't have an education, he had to go and he's always been a provider for my dad, so we, there was a lot of time throughout childhood he spent in prison. And obviously what was going on in the estate wasn't good. So that was the safe space for me, so I loved it. I took it up, I loved it, and then just got into it proper. And then when I got to 17, 18, failed an army test, decided to go and do what...
Are you glad you failed that test now?
Well, everything happens for a reason, doesn't it?
Yeah, cool.
And I'm a firm believer of that, because I always think, like, you know, if I'd never have... I wouldn't be in the position that I am now, had that not have happened. At the time, it was bad, especially what happened after it. That's kind of... I fell into that lifestyle, ended up in prison... Mm-hmm. 2003 come out, 2004 won the ABAs, fighting for England, everything looked like it was going, I got on funding had just been brought into play then, so I started getting monthly payments to box, I was living the dream, and then something come up from 18 months previously of a fight I was involved in, but I didn't cause, of a stupid, over frozen chips in a pizza shop.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
And then I come back and I got sent down for that because of my past. Yeah. And then it just felt like someone was always pulling me back. And then 2006, I'd met Jem 8 months before. Jem had bollocked me because she's not got a life like me growing up from different areas. And she, for me, everything was normalised.
Mm.
The violence was normalised. Mm-hmm. Going out drinking, mm-hmm. Taking drugs was normalised.
Mm-hmm.
So for her, and going to prison was normalised as well. You know, me, two brothers have been to prison. There's loads of people who we grew up with who went to prison. My dad went to prison. Everything was normalised. So it wasn't like out of the ordinary. But for her, it wasn't. And she made me realise that what you're doing is not normal. And it wasn't. So she was like, you want to start doing something for yourself? So I started focusing on myself and on Gemma. And then that's when things started to really... look up and be a lot more positive, like, you know. So when I come out the last time, Johnny Chisnall, who we spoke about earlier, he sadly passed away in 2005 whilst I was in prison. I couldn't go his funeral. One of the biggest regrets I'll have for the rest of my life, because he did a lot for me, John, and I come out 2006 and I went to Johnny Lyon, who had a gym in Wigan, and I literally got out and just went to him and said, John, listen, I need someone inside me. Someone inside me popped. It's a weird explanation. Spoke with a mate of mine a couple of months ago, and he's been clean from heroin for 6 years. He's an heroin addict, and he's been clean for 6 years. Every day is a fight for him. But he said he was on about the same thing, and he said something inside me popped, and that's exactly what happened to me. Anyway, I just thought, right, when I get out now, I'm going to change. So I went to Johnny Lyon's gym in Wigan, and I went, John, listen, mate, I need to do something now if I don't. I'm going to end up in jail. I'm going to be bad on drugs, John. I'm going to end up dead. And Johnny Lyon just helped me out, and he took me every day training. And then I was still on licence then, so with the British Boxing Board of Control, the professional side of things, this was amateur then, but the professional side of things, you can't get a professional career until you're free of any criminality.
Right, okay.
So I had to wait till my licence was up. And there was always temptations of obviously going back down that path, and it was quite hard to get rid of them. So that was a bit of a struggle. But then me and Gemma just got an house in Wigan, rented an house in Wigan, moved out the area. And we just stayed there and knuckled down. And then I got my professional license in 2007. And then I just didn't look back then. I just worked hard and, like, really focused and believed, and my mindset and outlook on life was so much, you know, more positive.
Yeah.
From where I was in my life previously,
mm-hmm.
anything I was doing positive was going to be a success in what I was doing. Yeah. But I always wanted to go anywhere and fight anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just trying my best to know when I retired that I give it my all, you know, and I completely dedicated my life to it and took on all challenges, and I did. And I can, you know, I'm at peace in retirement now knowing that I did that. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, the couple of decisions could have gone my way. Felix Sturm, Sergio Martinez, Arthur Abraham, could have gone my way. And in hindsight now, at the time I wasn't, I'm not bothered now, but at the time, like, I just think, right, it's just one of them, you know, just brush it off onto the next one. But now when I look back and I think, I was done out of a lot of money. But listen, it is what it is, but I was done out of a lot of money. Yeah, yeah. But I don't regret nothing. And, you know, like I said, everything happens for a reason. So all them little setbacks and, you know, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for them. So I'm you know, I'm happy and content with the person that I am and what I've got. Don't get me wrong, I could have more, but I could have so much less as well, Connor.
There was somebody else who was very influential in your life.
Yeah.
And that's somebody in your book that you call father.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be your granddad.
Yeah.
On your mum's side.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to me a bit about him.
Obviously, yeah, we called him Buller.
Right, okay.
My father, yeah. Like I said earlier, we do it. Johnny Chiz was the first one who took me to the gym. Chizzy and Buller, my father, were best mates.
Ah, right, okay.
Best mates.
Right.
Grew up on the same estate growing up. They were best mates.
Mm-hmm.
My father used to always take the mick out of me going on about, you used to call me fish and chips.
Right.
Because in the St. Helens Reporter, local paper, they used to have this thing called the name and shamed. And if you was in court, your name was there. Because he used to call me fish and chips because they used to put fish and chips in paper back in the day, and this is what he used to call me. And I just said, it's different now, isn't it, because of CCTV.
Mm.
When you and Chizzy were around, there wasn't none of that, but I guarantee you if there was, you'd have been banged up. He was a lovely fella, fella.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, him and John were best mates. He was the secretary at the club. He was up there every day. John first took me, then when I started getting into it, my father took me then.
Yeah.
So my mum and dad didn't drive. My dad drives and my mum still doesn't drive, but my dad didn't drive then. But he used to take me, He used to pick me up at the gym and take me and bring me home. But yeah, he was a good fella, the values that we've got now, all of us, like, we've all got really strong family values, and that definitely comes from, I mean, it's amazing what my dad's done.
Mm.
So proud of my dad, the upbringing he had, in and out the care system, and, you know, I always worked so much for his family, still working now. So proud of my dad, you know, he's got a top job, and he's grafted for that, worked for that. But I think the strong family value side comes from the green outside, definitely.
I decided to start the family tree with Martin's mum's side, the green outside, focusing on Buller's dad, Martin's great-granddad, a guy named John. John's birth certificate reveals that he was born on the 26th of July 1908. At the time of his birth, the family were living at Lawrenson Terrace in St Helens. John's dad is called Joseph and he was a general labourer, and his mum is called Elizabeth Greenhouse, formerly Davis. Now, the next record I have John on, which would be your great-granddad,
He's
on something called the 1911 census.
The 1911 census reveals that John is living with his dad and his grandparents at 70 Silkstone Street in St Helens. The head of the household is Joseph Greenhouse Sr., who was born in 1861 in Bolton. Also in the house is his wife, Margaret, John's dad, Joseph, John's uncle, John, John's other uncle, or William, John's auntie, Ellen, and John's grandma's brother, a guy called Charles Woods.
So there's quite a few generations in the same house.
Sorry, the same house?
Yes, they're all living in the same house.
Oh my god.
And if you have a look at the bottom, it'll actually tell you how many rooms were in the house.
Four rooms?
Yeah.
So what? Two. And they're all like, well, there's a couple of kids, but they're all like adults, aren't they?
Yeah, all in forums. If you actually look at the top column, if you look at Joseph and Margaret, it actually tells you how many children they've had, how many children were born alive, and how many children have died.
Oh, yeah. So they had four living and three who died.
Yeah, so they'd had seven children altogether, four were still alive, and three had sadly passed away. I also want you to draw your attention to Joseph Greenhouse, the son.
Widowed. Was he 25? Widowed at 25.
John is born in 1908. We know that from his birth certificate.
Yeah.
We know that by 1911, his mum has sadly passed away. And I've just got another document that I'd like to show you now.
The witness lamp tragedy inquest was concluded on Monday. The jury returned a verdict of death from extensive burns. Deceased was Elizabeth Greenhalgh's wife, chemical labourer named Joseph Greenhalgh. She was placed under arrest in consequence of evidence given when the inquest was opened. We got nicked for it. A neighbour said she heard someone threaten to throw a lamp, and a minute or two later, she heard a crash and a scream. She ran into the house and found the deceased with her underclothing on fire. In her dying depositions, Mrs. Ginnell said she was in bed when she heard a noise like a shot. On jumping up, she found the lamp ablaze, and when she seized it, the oil flowed onto her clothing, setting on fire. The woman's father also said that Mrs. Ginnell denied that her husband had caused the burns. After the inquest, Greenhalgh was remanded by the magistrates.
On the 3rd of September 1910, Joseph and Elizabeth Greenhalgh returned home with a portion of chips and a quart of ale. After eating the food, the pair went to bed, which was in the kitchen. Sometime after 11:30, a neighbour named Sarah Thompson was walking past the house when she heard a man's voice say, "If you don't shut up, I'll throw the lamp." A few minutes later, she hears a smash. The neighbour rushes in and sees Elizabeth on fire. Elizabeth was taken to the local hospital, and while receiving treatment, she stated that she was in bed when she heard a noise. She got up and she saw the lamp ablaze. As she grabbed hold of it, her underclothing caught on fire. 4 days after the event, Elizabeth died from extensive burns. Joseph was apprehended for the crime. However, reports from the nurse who looked after Elizabeth in hospital and also her dad contradicted what the neighbour had said. He was subsequently released without charge. Had Joseph gone to prison, that would mean Martin's great-granddad, John, Buller's dad, would have had no mum or no dad to take care of him.
Elizabeth admitted when she was in hospital that they'd not had perfect marriage.
Yeah.
I just found this. So this is from 1909.
Joseph Greenhalgh, belonging to St. Helens, was summoned by his wife Elizabeth for arrears of maintenance amounting to £4.13/6.
Yeah. That's quite a lot of money,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, is it? At witness on Monday, defendant was described by solicitor Mr. Knowles as having been out of employment 4 months and had not been able to pay anything since the order was made last October. Having tramped to various parts in search of employment but was unable to get it, defendant's mother offered to take a small house for them in St. Helens, but complainant declined the invitation. She said she would go back to her husband if he would take house away from his family.
I don't think Elizabeth particularly liked the Greenhouse family. I think she wanted to raise her child away from the family.
Yeah.
But that then got me digging to think, well, why didn't she like the family? So
like a lie roll.
I'm just going to pass you this article, and it's called Like a Shambles, and it's from 1906.
Like a shambles, strange scene at a St. Helens house. St. Helens on Monday, Joseph Greenhalgh's labourer was remanded for a week charged with having unlawfully stabbed his wife on Saturday night. Chief Inspector Goodall, according to the chief constable, on going to the house, found the woman lying on the sofa, saturated with blood and suffering from two dangerous wounds on the lower part of her body. There were two men stripped naked to the waist, fighting. There were also about 30 women in the house urging them on. That was like a big orgy, didn't it? The place was like a shambles and they were just like lions fighting. Oh my God. Didn't expect this. From Greenhalgh's side. From Morris, fair enough, not from Greenhalgh's.
I think they're probably quite a rowdy.
Yeah,
family.
Yeah.
And maybe Elizabeth thought that she didn't want John being around that environment.
Yeah.
But
Crazy.
He does go to prison for that incident. He pleads guilty to the crime, and he basically said that they'd had an argument. He was upset. He was irritated by the fighting. He struck her, but he didn't remember having a knife in his hand. He was really sorry for what happened. The judge sort of said to him, look, if this had gone to the Assize Courts, which is like our Crown Courts, you know, you would have been severely punished.
Yeah.
But because we've kept, because you've admitted it and it's kept at the local courts, you will only serve 5 months in prison. So he goes to prison for 5 months. So you can imagine, up to this point, John probably has your great-granddad, not the most stablest.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say starts in life.
Following the death of Elizabeth, Joseph and his young son John leave St Helens and move to Widnes. In 1914, he marries a widow by the name of Mary Lewis. 2 days before the wedding, Britain had declared war on Germany. The impact of World War I would devastate the Greenhouse family. John's dad, Joseph, along with his two brothers, John and William, all sign up to fight.
Now, the first one to sign up was John. That's the middle son. And he signed up in 1914. And at the time, he was working for Pilkington Glass.
Yeah.
William, the youngest of the three brothers, he signs up next. He signs up in Warrington on the 1st of January, 1915. And he's also working for Pilkington Glass. Now, you're probably thinking, why isn't John's dad, Joseph, working for Pilkington Glass? Well, I can tell you why he's not working for Pilkington Glass like the others. And that's because he gets sacked from Pilkington's.
An apprentice named Joseph Greenhalgh of Gerrards Bridge St Helens was summoned by his employers, Messrs Pilkington Brothers, at the St Helens Police Court this morning, neglecting his work. MEPs prosecuted and said that so far back as the 17th of June 1901, there was an order obtained against him to attend to his work. On the 5th of May 1902, another summons was taken out against him and he got 14 days. After his imprisonment, he worked unsatisfactorily until the 9th of March this year and he not since attended his work. Defendant did not appear on the bench, thinking it would be better for him to be present to offer any excuse, adjourn the case till Monday week.
He went to St Helens Police Court for neglecting his work. He did end up going to prison for 14 days for doing it. So that's why when the war happens and everybody signs up in the family and they all work for Pilkington Glass, he doesn't. So William signs up. Obviously, he's working at Pilkington. He joins the South Lancs Regiment on the 1st of January 1915. Joseph, who's John's dad, who's the oldest of the boys, he signs up on the 4th of January 1915 in Warrington. And he's posted to the 2nd Battalion of the South Lancashire Regiment on the 20th of January 1915. Only a few days before William and Joseph sign up, their mum receives news that I don't think any mum would want to receive, and that is that John has been captured by the Germans and he's been held in a prisoner of war camp. With him being held in a prisoner of war camp, excuse me, so then after that, watch your other two sons, your only two sons, sign up. That must have been really difficult.
Yeah.
That must have been, I mean, you've got kids.
Yeah,
right?
God, yeah, I couldn't even
Can
think
you
about,
imagine what that must have been like? Now, out of the two brothers that then have just signed up, out of Joseph and William does seem to adapt to military life, I'd say just a bit quicker than Joseph. So he rises up the ranks quite quickly.
Yeah.
And by 1915, he is appointed acting sergeant. So he moves up quite quickly.
Yeah.
Now, Joseph, on the other hand, he wasn't the most well-behaved soldier when he first joined. So he gets into trouble for being absent 3 times. And he was fined in one instance in February of 1915. He was actually detained for 21 days for being absent from inspection while under orders for active service. On the 22nd of September, the battalion is involved in some really heavy fighting close to Hooge. We know from the war diary that the conditions were really tough, Mark.
Yeah.
So the day started off pretty muggy, and by the evening, the rain commenced and it lasted for over 2 hours. This made conditions really uncomfortable for the soldiers. And at some point during that day, that Joseph is injured in a shrapnel shell explosion. I have his medical records, if you'd like to see it.
Oh, yeah.
I've got them here.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, let's have a look. That's unbelievable. 26 September 1915, deceased. Shrapnel shell, wound left leg, arm and ankle. Patient was admitted 26 September 1915. He was found by a shrapnel shell explosion on 22nd of September 1915, injected with anti-atenic serum. 23rd of September. Patient stated they had only been dressed once since being wounded on the 24th. On admission, the leg showed two large wounds on either side of the leg. There was a compound comminuted fracture of the tibia, the wound of exit being large and ragged. Discharge was foul and pussy. Ooh. The ankle showed a small superficial wound. The forearm showed several small wounds on the anterior surface and one on the posterior. General condition, patient is ill, looks anxious and shows some collapse. Temperature 100 Fahrenheit, pulse 120. 27th of September, patient is worse. The leg is swollen and the wounds are more offensive. Gangrene has commenced. Patient has a rigor in the afternoon and became somewhat delirious. Patient was taken to the operating theatre and under gas and the amputation of the lower third of the thigh was performed. The method used was circular, flapping straight through the bone. Gas gangrene was present in the amputated portion of the limb. Patient took the anaesthetic badly and no more was given after, so he died. The leg was removed, the wound was left open. 28th of September, the gas gangrene spread up the limb and into the pelvis. Patient dying at 12:30. Oh, God bless him.
The person who carried out the actual amputation on his leg and fought to save his life was a guy called Sir Harold Delph Gillies. He was a New Zealand surgeon who was posted to France in 1915. And he is a really esteemed surgeon. He's regarded as the father of plastic surgery. Wow. And he pioneered facial reconstructive surgery for soldiers during the war. Now, his medals and all his possessions, and I'll let you, you can take that back with you, you can have a look at it at some point.
Yeah.
His medals and all his possessions would naturally go to his new wife.
Yeah.
But she is very clear that they are kept in trust for John. For Buller's dad, right? So she's very clear that they are kept in trust. That basically, not she's got children of her own from another marriage. They are kept for him. I've got a picture of him if you want to see it.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say he's got a green arch nose, like
that's Buller's granddad. Great granddad.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the war.
Yeah.
We've got John, who's been taken in a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
We've got Joseph, who has sadly passed away. And then we've got William, who is still fighting, which must have been, you know, you'd probably just want him home, wouldn't you? A bit like Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah,
like, let's just bring him home. William, at this point, when Joseph dies, is still on home soil. He hasn't gone to France yet. He's not posted to France until July of 1917. And that year, he was promoted to Lance Sergeant. Now, during the autumn of 1917, his battalion, which was the 8th Regiment of the South Lancs, were involved in some really heavy battles. And unfortunately, William is killed in action on the 18th of November, 1917. So she's lost William.
Yeah.
She's lost Joseph. John is
still out.
Is still out. So that's her only son.
Yeah.
Is still somewhere in a prisoner of war camp. John remains in the prisoner of war camp for 4 years.
Yeah.
He doesn't get out. Well, he writes actually in October of 1918. He writes home and says that he's hoping to be released imminently. But it doesn't quite happen straight away. He gets released on Boxing Day of 1918. I've got a picture of John, if you want to see it. And I've also got the letter that he wrote that appeared in the local press.
Fascinating, this, isn't it? Like how you can find out sort of, you know, the issue that you don't have and that you don't know about. And
so that is him writing to his dad.
Dear father, at last a long talk of exchange of prisoners between England and Germany is about to take place, and I and a lot of my companions expect to arrive in England in October. I hope you received the photo I sent safely, and if so, you might put it in the St. Helens newspaper. I also wish to thank you with all my heart, the kind friends who, joining my captivity, have continued to dispatch parcels of food and clothing to me. You might also ask some of them to drop me a line now and again, trusting to see you all soon. I remain free, etc. John Green Ulch, South Lancs Regiment 1035, Norway.
I've got a picture of him. Do you want to see a picture?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
It's not the best picture because it's taken from a newspaper, but you can kind of see what he looks
God,
like.
God, yeah.
He's got a strong tash game going on.
Yeah, naughty tash, haven't he? Yeah, curling up at the sides as well. Amazing.
Now, I'm going to stick with that family because you may think you are the only sportsman in your family. But I would like to tell you, Martin Murray, that you are not.
That's amazing.
Oh,
can't wait. Listen to this. Yeah.
Sticking with Martin's mum's side of the tree, if we go back to Martin's great-great-great-grandfather, Joseph, he had a cousin who was a famous footballer. Samuel Greenhouse signed for Bolton Wanderers in 1902, and in 1905, Bolton were runners-up in the league. Now, he remained at Bolton Wanderers until he made his big money move to Aston Villa in 1906. His transfer fee was a reported £550, and for that, he received £10. He went on to make 32 appearances for Aston Villa during the 1906-1907 season, and he was never substituted. However, he couldn't settle in Birmingham and he wanted to go back home to Bolton. Aston Villa didn't want to let him go and their supporters apparently were unhappy. But with interest from other clubs such as Liverpool, Bolton had to pay Villa £700 for the transfer in 1907. Bolton went on to win the league in 1909 and he stayed at Bolton until 1913, making 163 league appearances. He did play in the FA Cup final in the 1903-1904 season, and that's where Bolton lost 1-0 to Manchester City. He never won a full England cap, although he was named as a substitute on two occasions. After retiring, Samuel went back to work. He worked as a labourer in an iron foundry and then as a road sweeper.
You may be wondering what sort of training Bolton were doing at this time.
Ah, so the boxing.
So part of their training regime.
And he's no way.
He's in that image, is boxing. So here is a picture of him in his Bolton Wanderers kit. And he's the gentleman with his arms crossed. How hard is it, Martin, when you retire?
Yeah.
And you go from, like this guy has gone from thousands of people screaming his name every week to then being a normal sort of civilian on the street.
Yeah.
Is that transition hard?
I mean, it is.
I mean, I know it's different because there was no money then.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I know, like, you can basically now plough your time into your charity work and helping others. Obviously for him, he probably just did whatever he could to put food on.
Yeah, that's it, just to survive, yeah. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, especially for him, like the money he'd be getting paid back then. Yeah, it must just be, God, really humbling for him, isn't it? Like, you know what I mean? But it is hard, speaking personally, it is hard. I'm guessing for him, especially if you're not ready to retire. I was lucky I was ready to retire, so the transition was a lot more easier than it might have been for him. Like, you know, I never knew that.
Did you not know?
I would links up with boxing gloves there and as well. Wonder what he was like as a fighter.
I'm just going to show you. There is a particular road that is really prominent in your family tree on the Greenhouse side, right? And that is Silkstone Street. Silkstone Street is where your family lived, and it's where sort of all these events tended to happen on the Greenhouse side.
Right, okay. Wonder where that is now. Be interesting to know that, wouldn't it?
But it links quite nicely. You probably think that your mum's side of the family and your dad's side of the family didn't know each other before your mum and dad got together, right? Or they might maybe a generation back.
Yeah,
but before
that,
I imagine you probably wouldn't have thought they'd have known each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can tell you that your great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents on your mum and your dad's side did actually know each other because on the 1911 census, they were neighbours.
Were they?
So one family lives at 70 And the other family lives at 72 Silkstone Street.
Next door?
Next door to each other.
So my mum's great-grandparents and my dad's great-grandparents...
Great-great-great-grandparents live next door to each other.
Wow.
70 and 72.
That's mental, isn't it?
And then, three, four generations later...
Yeah.
The kids would meet and marry. And you're here. So all the goings-on with the Greenhouse family, it obviously didn't put the Murray side off.
Because no.
they still met. So let's move on to the Murray side.
Yeah.
So... you are actually not Martin Murray.
Right.
Don't worry. Right. Yeah. If we go back in your family tree and we go to your great-granddad.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you his birth certificate and then I'll explain what I mean. He was born on the 28th of July, 1891. And the family at the time were living in Mill Street.
Yeah.
But you'll notice, if I just swizzle this round, that there's a gap where the dad is.
Yeah.
And that is because when his mum, Mary Ellen, had him, she had him out of wedlock and she's not listed the dad. If we're thinking traditionally, where you take the name of your dad, that means that when we go to your great-granddad, the Murray name comes from his mum, not his dad.
Technically, it would have been something different.
It wouldn't have been Murray.
Yeah.
I can tell you a bit about his mum then, if we talk a bit about her.
Yeah.
So she has him in 1891. At the time, she's employed as a servant. He's born in the July, and the census is taken just a couple of months before that, the 1891 census. She's on that census working for a family in West Derby, Liverpool.
Yeah.
And the family are butchers. And she must have been heavily pregnant at that time. But she must have been hiding it because as soon as you were pregnant, you would have lost your job.
Yeah.
So she must have been concealing the fact that she was pregnant. So we know William is born in 1891. And then his son is Alfred.
Yeah.
Who would be your grandfather. And when I was looking for him... I actually found a record, and the reason I found this record, by the way, is because when I looked for the grave, there was somebody in the grave that I couldn't place. And I actually found that the person that I couldn't place was Alfred's brother.
Right.
This article relates to Alfred's brother, and Alfred's brother is called William.
Right.
Right?
Since Ellen's boy's tragic mistake, poisoning a fruit.
Yeah.
Unusual case of a schoolboy's death resulting from poisoning due to his having eaten part of a wild plant was investigated at St. Helens today. The inquest was on William Murray, aged 13, of 9 Bolton Street, St. Helens, who died in the Providence Hospital on Tuesday. The boys went to a pit and pulled up some plants by the roots. They broke off a portion of the root and took it to a dirty, stagnant pit nearby. There they washed it and thought it was sweet-scented flag. Some of the boys tried to chew it, but did not like it and spat out. Murray was said to have swallowed some of it. Wow. And he died off that.
So that's your granddad's brother. So he was only 13.
Oh, yeah, so my dad's uncle.
Yeah.
Starting with Martin's granddad, Alf, I have managed to trace the Murray line all the way back to Ireland. John Murray, born in 1835, was the first of the Murrays to come and settle in the northwest. In 1864, he marries Mary Hora in Prescott, and the couple go on to have 4 children, 3 girls and 1 boy. Records suggest that John came from Galway in Ireland. We don't know much about his early life, but when he came to St. Helens, he found employment as a coal miner.
So Martin, that's it for your tree.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing that, thank you. It's been...
I was going to say, reflecting on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel a little bit like, you know, well, one is... you can kind of explain, like, well, going back to the Greenhouse, you say, for example, how he was always in trouble, and, you know, that's pretty much like, you know, the apple never falls far from the tree, does it? Like, so we've kind of, that's been carried on, but, and then obviously the Murray side, it's might, like, the fit, I'm getting a bit of a strange feeling, because it's bringing up thoughts that I didn't know he had, and, you know, that I didn't think he had, and I'm thinking now, and I can't wait to tell my mum, tell my dad. But I think it's fair to say that the Murrays are the best they've ever been, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? And how we're doing, like, for what we've gone on in the past. So yeah, it's been really, really good and really interesting. And my mind's just going to be working overtime now, just thinking of things. But thanks for that. It's been brilliant. I think that's the vicious circle finally brought now. It's been really, really interesting.
I would have loved to have gone round for a Christmas party. Can you imagine on Silverstone Street?
Can't wait to find out where that is or where it used to be.
Martin Murray, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
So that is it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for Martin for letting us investigate and delve into his family history. And a huge thank you to you as well for listening. You can probably tell by my voice that I've been under the weather for the past few days. That's why I didn't release a podcast last week, because I literally had no voice. The joy. Anyway, we crack on. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to our sponsor this week, Whitney Antiques. Thank you so much. I couldn't make these special episodes without you. Also to Ancestry for providing me with the DNA kit. And to four of my students from the University of Birmingham who have been doing some research for this show. That's Amy Boyd, Olivia Chapman, Emma Matthews, and Matilda DeManet. Thank you so much. Don't forget, if you like this podcast, please remember to download and subscribe. If you want to get in contact with me, you can do so via my website, which is www.michaelahume.com. I've got a very special episode for you next week. Get your tissues ready. Have a great week researching. Don't forget, this is the time to quiz your relatives during this Christmas break. This is the perfect time to start your family tree. Have a great week researching. See you next week.